Welcome to Emotionally Correct, a hilarious DEIA podcast with Kelton and Charisse from IDEA.
Oh, hi.
Hey, what's going on? How you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm still trying to piece together all the things from the conference, right?
Yeah.
So it was a lot came in.
I don't know what episode number this is, but welcome to Emotionally Correct.
Emotionally Correct.
Hilarious DEI podcast. So welcome, everybody. We went to the Facing Race conference in St. Louis, Missouri. It's a two-day conference. There were about 4,000 people there, which was bigger
crazy
than
number of people.
It was going to be.
Crazy number of people.
It seemed to be a combination of people like us from organizations, but also, and about, seemed like at least about half the attendees, because they had their own track, were from the government, because there is a Government Alliance on Race and Equity, is a, I don't know how you describe it, I'm going to look it up, but look at that. GAR is a dynamic peer-to-peer learning and practice network dedicated to advancing racial equity in government. I don't know how it's actually funded, but there were probably 2,000 people there from government agencies, and then another couple thousand of us from other places. And I don't know about you, but it was really fun for me to see that many people who care about race all in one place.
Yeah, fun. I think when I walked in, fun is a stretch for me. I felt overwhelmed when I walked in and saw the sheer size of the banquet hall. I think that's when it dawned on me. I mean, we were hearing 4,000, whatever, but you don't really have a feel of the scope of that till you see a space that's going to contain or hold all those people. So when I saw that, I was almost overwhelmed. And yes, it was amazing to think that all these people showed up for this purpose of diversity and equity. Blew my mind.
Yeah. Were you surprised at how many white people were there?
You know, that's a great question. I was not surprised per se. However, I looked at the white people, right, and tried to think, who's that, right? Like, where are you coming from, right? What's your background? And I had to have a little bit of a shift, right? Because this isn't like I'm walking into just a random public space. And so that there are individuals in this space who are anti to this space, right? I think what was powerful was thinking all these white people are on the same team, right? They're on the same team. And that was really a different feel for me to experience.
Yeah. As a white person, I've remarked before that sometimes this work feels lonely because there are various levels of kind of everything from overt hostility to, yes, I'm definitely on the same team as you. But most people kind of, when I say what I do or say what my dissertation is on, I often get like, oh, that's nice. How about them Ravens? Right? Like sometimes people are uncomfortable. They don't know how to engage and they, I don't know. But so for me, it was lovely to see so many other white people, whether or not we have anything in common beyond having been at this conference or whether or not, you know, because I sometimes still sit in that space of judgment around how well other white people are doing on this journey. It's just hard. Competition and all of that. I mean, there's so much about white supremacy culture that when you look at another white person trying to do racial equity work, all this sort of like dominant cultural elements come in. But I thought it was a really cool space. I was really happy to see so many people there. And I was also overwhelmed at the volume of concurrent panels. So at any given time when we were in breakout sessions, we had like 40 things to pick from, which made it really hard to not feel like you're missing something by not going in all the places. And It was you and I and another colleague friend of ours. So we tried to divide and conquer. So I'm really, and you and I haven't had a chance to sort of catch up on like the things you went to and the things I went to. So the purpose of today's podcast is to talk about the conference and also think about what it has caused in our own reflection about the work we're trying to do in the time period that we're in post-election. So I give a lot of credit to that group of people who put this event on because it was massive.
Wait, you took the words right out of my mouth. Yeah, it was massive and well choreographed, I would say. Yeah. You know, from everything from the location and the information provided to attend the groups, these breakout groups starting on time, being efficiently run, people being prepared, to just something as basic as meal prep and delivery. You know, the food was good and served in a way that you never felt overwhelmed, like standing in the line. So that was powerful to me. So yeah, kudos to that team and group of people who took that work on, because that was phenomenal.
Last thing I'll say about logistics, it only happens every 2 years. So I am grateful that we had the chance to go. And I know that we talked about, okay, 2 years from now, maybe we'll get to do a workshop.
I would love that. That would be amazing.
Because I looked through the entire list of workshops, and social emotional competence and emotional intelligence in the context of supporting folks in doing this, the emotional work necessary. I didn't see a lot of that. So I think there's space, you know, I think there's space, and maybe by 2 years from now, everyone will be talking about it. So that would be great. So I don't know, where do you want to start?
Well, I think where I want to start is just kind of an observation, right? So we talked about arriving and having this feeling of gratitude that so many people from so many walks of life and industries and government were there to support the same purpose. And at first blush, you know, it's amazing. It looks like one unified front. But for me, what was really a powerful experience was learning the nuance in how people see the same thing. So here we go. We're at a place, and everyone's goal is kind of the overarching goal is the same, but how we approach it, how we interpret it, how we see it, what we hold as the significant and most important parts of it are so vastly different.
Yeah.
And honestly, some of it kind of didn't resonate with me. And I'll even go further to say some of it actually rubbed me the wrong way. And I you know, I almost felt embarrassed to admit that to anybody. Like, I'm like, I'm sitting there with this. I can talk to you and our other colleague. And I'm like, wow, you know, we weren't together. I'm in breakout groups on my own. And I'm like, I feel like I am seeing things through a different lens than most of the people in this room. And that became both an enlightening moment, but also a moment, quite frankly, that I felt alone. And it felt some degree of trepidation in how I would speak to that, because it didn't seem to be a lot of room for the way I was thinking about things. What about you?
Yeah, well, I want to dig in a little bit more with you.
Let's dig it.
Can so, you dig it? You know, I think in any space like that, people who do think differently or for whom the content is sort of rubbing them the wrong way, like you, they feel like they might be the only person in the room. And so they don't really say anything. So I think it's hard to gauge whether or not this really was an echo chamber or not. I do worry about that all the time, right? If you host an event called Facing Race, you're going to get a lot of people who want to talk about race. And there's a lot of deference to celebrity in the space, little c celebrity, right? So if you're someone on stage, or you've written a book, or you have a big job somewhere, running something, and you espouse a certain point of view, I think there's less, it feels like sometimes there's less room for little peons like me to be like, I don't agree with that. because why else would this person be in a position of power in this movement if that wasn't the prevailing point of view?
Yeah.
So obviously this was a few weeks after the conference, after the election, and we started getting emails from the conference hosts saying, oh, I'm sure everyone is devastated. Oh my gosh, don't despair. Let's take a moment to grieve, and then we'll come together in community and we will figure out how to launch an offensive in response to basically what was framed as the election was lost to Donald Trump because and only because of white supremacy and misogyny.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this was white man versus black woman election. And that the reduction of the entire what happened to that sentence was really prevalent both in the messages we got ahead of time and then almost everyone on stage. And the language, we've talked about this on another podcast, but the language really sat in the space of othering the people who voted for Trump. And the space making really was, it was more of a circle the wagons, bring up the moat, like let's huddle in to our space because we need to fight those people. And I found that challenging because, first of all, I find it comforting because that's what I want to do. I want to villainize. I want to fight.
Yeah.
And I want to say, wasn't me.
Yeah.
It was those people.
That's a great place to be because it protects us. It gives us traction. It allows us to not accept responsibility. Yeah, it's their fault over there.
Their fault. You know,
that's all point of view. Yeah.
So right from the, not even before we got there, we were set up to come into the space in a particular posture of almost attending a funeral. only to discover at the funeral that our loved one didn't die of natural causes, but they were murdered. And now the job is to do the detective work.
Yes, forensic work of figuring out why and who.
We got to come up. Yeah, we got to get on the case and go on the offensive. So I don't know. I know we're going to talk a lot about that, but I, like you, thought, am I the only person sitting in this room thinking, I think it's more complicated than white man defeated black woman because of white men? I think that there's nuance in the who voted for whom and why that you just don't get in the 10 minutes after the election has been called.
Yeah.
And I'm also not trying to diminish, nor do I think you are. I don't think we're trying to diminish the role that race and gender play. But if we leave it at that, what room is there, right? What room is there to think about what aren't we hearing about what people are going through? And last thing I'll say is I think that I won't speak for you. I think living here in DC and having lived here for almost 30 years now, being in a multicultural city, it's highly segregated in its housing, but in the spaces I occupy work-wise and always have, like my exposure to people across race and class is different than my high school friends who never left my hometown in Canton, Ohio.
Absolutely.
And so I think I have a distorted view of what matters to people because I only see what matters to people in this weird urban city that's both a big town and a small town. that's both multicultural and highly segregated, but where the full band of socioeconomic class is experienced here in ways that, you know, I think lots of people don't have. So how am I somebody who can pontificate on why someone in a small town in Ohio voted the way they voted?
Yeah, you made so many good points. I was trying to keep notes and I don't know if I did. let's start there though. I think that becomes a challenge to try to figure out why the person of color or the white person in small town, rural America voted in a certain way or fashion, right? I think it is difficult. However, I believe that being in this big town, little town, segregated, integrated, multi-educational, struggling for a foothold town, which is Washington, metropolitan area, I think it's enough of a sample size for us to understand one thing clearly, and that is, did that person in rural town America, regardless of their color, gender, or background, have an opportunity to be heard and not be othered? And so what I saw in the zeitgeist of the 4,000 was this temptation to other, was this temptation to point fingers, to blame, to excuse, and not to actually ask the questions, right? In order to get an answer that can help you to understand, you have to ask questions that are meaningful, thoughtful, and germane to the individual from whom you're trying to extract information. And so I don't feel as if the right questions were being asked, right? Large assumptions were being made about blocks of people as if they were silos and stood alone, and not understanding the shared concern that so many people have that cross over race, gender, and all those other categories we can identify. And then I begin to see that play out in the spaces we were in, right? Trying to find commonality, but more importantly, Charisse, what I really felt one of the challenges was in the larger group and in the breakout sessions was really trying to create a space where there was enough psychological safety that the peon like me or you could step forward and say, hey, I see things differently. And I think that was my takeaway, was there was a lot of talk about it and maybe even attempts to do it, but I don't think there was enough actual work done to help people feel comfortable enough to honestly express themselves in differing opinions.
So it's really interesting that you say that, because sometimes I think we have perverted the concept of psychological safety to mean I will not be challenged.
Yeah.
In my perspective.
Yes, yes.
And I feel like this is the thing about, sometimes I get like really twisted when I think about therapy, right? I love therapy, personal individual therapy. I always have. Yeah. It's been very useful for me. But the worst therapists I've had have been people who simply, I would talk, share my thoughts, my perspective, whatever, basically sharing my critical thinking errors. And someone would say, yeah, say more about that, right? Or listen, we all want to be validated. I want you to hear what I have to say. And from my, even if they are complete critical thinking errors, I want you to say, I get what that must be like for you to think and feel that way.
Right.
That, unless somebody says that to me, I then can't hear. Let me offer you a different perspective. But I feel like often in these spaces, so I'm grateful to have a therapist who tells me, that's just simply wrong the way you're thinking. But yeah, she doesn't do it that way. And she does it after asking me to sort of look inside and
hug
my inner child and comfort my inner child and all of that stuff. Because all those critical thinking errors come from our inner child who made decisions about at a certain age. And so, but in these spaces, the psychological safety almost seems to come at the expense of any kind of challenge, almost as if the challenge is disrespectful. So I don't envy you, right? Because in spaces where you want to talk to other Black folks about healing from being racialized, you have some specific thoughts about asking the question, what do we get out of sitting in the space? Ooh, I even hesitate to say this out loud on this podcast, right?
I know. Come on.
I would say it to you if I was alone with you, but not with all these people. What are we getting out of sitting in this victimization space?
Yeah, yeah. And we're probably going to get some letters and emails because you said that.
Yeah. I'm not going to, like, you can say that. I'm not going to say that. But
no. Go ahead.
I worry. So. If you said that in a space, could you get accused of not providing psychological safety?
Oh, absolutely. Not only that, then they're looking at my insensitivity towards individuals' position, discounting people's experience, and I struggle, right? Because I'm saying, look, recently, after the conference, I started doing a lot of reading and research, and I wish I had my notes in front of me because I don't want to misquote anybody, but just looking at trauma and the relationship of the individual committing the trauma and the person that is being traumatized, and the shifts in behavior of the individual being traumatized to adjust in a way to cope with the person committing the trauma. And the behaviors that are adapted to be able to survive in a normal framework are totally, what's the word I want to use? Are totally behaviors that are contraindicate normal behavior or healthy behavior, right? They are the
all coping strategies. Coping strategies are unhealthy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, With that as our premise, if the perpetrator undergoes a radical change and does work, and even if the change isn't immediate, but slowly begins to change, if the individual that has been traumatized isn't also doing work of healing, then the behavior remains the same in how they respond to the person that has committed the trauma. This is how I see where we are. And all I wanted to say in a couple of my settings was, hey guys, as an exercise of just thought, is there any value to us individuals, as people of color, doing emotional work, the same kind of emotional work we're asking white folk to do? Is there any value in us doing work in order to be better prepared to engage in a more healthy dynamic as the other side does work? No room for that. No room for that, right? In fact, and I'll just be specific, and I'm sitting in a safety, in a workplace safety and a strategy session of creating safety.
Oh yeah, you went to one called something about creating psychologically safe spaces.
Yes.
Blah, blah, blah.
So here I am, super excited.
Right.
I'm bringing all my experience from Gestalt in. I'm like so ready, right? I take up a position on the floor because it's packed out. This is a packed session, standing room only. And there is a white woman who's conducting it, very well qualified from her credentials. And she's doing real well in, I would say, the first 15, 20 minutes of the session. Then comes a critical moment where a white woman is expressing the desire to continue the work she's doing in an environment where she's getting input from Black folk. A Black woman raises her hand and says, I don't want no parts of that. Like, you white people, go do your thing. You need to do your work and show up when you're ready. not a philosophy that's so far out from a lot of people's thinking.
Yeah.
But in that moment, I felt psychologically unsafe because I didn't hold the same view exactly, right? And I looked around the room, and all that happened was a clear co-signing from both Black and white folk that just said, yeah, that's what has to happen. And then the facilitator was like, yes, that's what. I'm like, wow. So we're not even going to challenge and think, is there another modality? Are there other needs that may not be being met? This woman just expressed her need to interact with other Black folk in the work that she's doing to better understand her own work. Agree or disagree, her need is valid. And there was no room to explore that, and even greater, no room for anybody to bring up this idea. I turned to the white woman next to me. We had a brief exchange, and I say to her, how does that make you feel? Her eyes were as wide as saucers. She looked at me and she said, I'm really uncomfortable because I need help, right? We had a short exchange. I won't go into all that, but my takeaway from that moment was, in the very environment where we're trying to teach, understand, and have psychological safety, it went out the room, out the window. And from that moment on, my feeling was we had lost the opportunity for psychological safety in a space that was teaching that.
Yeah, I mean, we could spend a whole episode talking about the modality of multicultural affinity spaces and then single race affinity spaces. I've had experience, obviously, at my old job of having a facilitated environment with therapists facilitating us in these spaces. It's really interesting. I think about this less from a race perspective sometimes than I think about it from a gender perspective, right? Because I'm raising a son. And I would like my white male son to be non-toxically masculine and alert and awake and observant about the power he wields simply by his mere existence, even when he doesn't feel like he has power. It's a balance, right?
Yeah.
And I think that is often what's challenging for poor white folks in the space talking about privilege.
Sure.
If you've grown up in a small town as a poor white person, which I have not, but from what I hear and the movies I've seen, and just what I've studied, the experience of being disadvantaged economically, this is why people say we have more in common than we have differences, because there are some commonalities around economic deprivation and educational deprivation that all poor people share. And you add race onto that, and you add gender and all the other intersecting identities. I get it. But I think that the feeling of how do I do my own work, I get that. Oh, back to thinking about it with my son. Like, I have the emotional bandwidth to sit with my kid if he wants to process what masculinity in America looks and sounds and feels like, and his own struggle with sort of like, if he needs to process a time in which he wasn't paying attention to his privilege and had a bad experience or whatever, right? So being able to self-regulate and being able to sit and hold space for someone else's processing requires some emotional health on my side, right? And some capacity on my side to not take personally or be emotionally triggered by his processing.
Right.
And often when I think I hear people say, like, go off and do your own work, don't process that shit around me, I think, oh, that's because I couldn't the person saying that, we talk about it like we don't want to emotionally burden people of color with having to process, be in the room with white people processing white feelings. Or I would just call them feelings of guilt and shame and all the other, and the crying or whatever that people say. But as you said, if that is that lack of interest and or capacity to sit with someone else's processing a coping strategy from the trauma associated with all of this stuff, right? Like if my cup is empty, then I can't interact with you while you're dealing with your cup. I'm not saying it's people's it's your job, but I am saying that as opposed to that being celebrated as a kind of like fuck you to white people, like, yeah, we told those white people, go do their own work. It's, ooh, is there something interesting about wanting people to go do their own work and not burden you with it? What does that mean you need?
Yeah, and here's the thing. I think that what we have to keep in mind is that none of this is an either or. And the woman of color who was expressing her lack of capacity or an empty cup to keep with the metaphor to do the work with the white woman who was expressing the need is fine, and I think it can be respected.
Sure.
But when you speak for all, right? I think and this is where how we talk to one another becomes so critical. I think if we can understand that I can express a point of view or a feeling as mine, I own it. So I think it would have landed very differently in the room if she had said, wow, I hear your need. I'm not a Black woman who can support that because my cup is empty. Yeah. I don't have the bandwidth to sit with you. But to simply make a blanket statement and then for people to co-sign it, whether they believed it or not, creates an idea, concept, and a way of thinking in a group of people that walk away and think, oh, I guess that's kind of like the way it is,
yeah,
whether I agree with it or not. So, and look, I have to take ownership of my own inability in that moment to have stood and said what was on my mind. And I regret it. And I have made a promise to myself. I will never be in another group. I will never sit in another environment where I don't say what I feel and think in the moment where it's pertinent and germane. I will not do that. There was a woman who stood up and did say, you guys aren't going to like what I said, what I'm about to say, and did speak a little to that. I then seconded her. However, it was not, it didn't open up the room for an opportunity for discussion, nor did it say, hey, here's an opportunity for us to have more psychological safety. I was a little disappointed in the facilitator because I felt it was a great opportunity for her to say, wow, how do you all feel about that? Right? The very things she had on the board, right? The very questions that she was saying we should ask when we're sitting in a group to create psychological safety. We didn't do any of those.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think this is a really interesting kind of like thread running through the whole conference and running through the dialogue that is out there in our space right now, which is that this homogeneity of thought, right? That all in the same way we're like, you know, Black people are not a homogeneous group.
Right.
There are variations in thought and opinion and feelings, and it is part of implicit bias or stereotype to say, oh, well, if Kelton said X, Kelton must speak for all Black people everywhere, right? Or this woman who stood up and said, y'all white people go off and do your own work, as if she spoke for all Black people everywhere. So yeah. We as white people are, you know, we're part of our work is to, and this isn't just about race. Men think this about women. Women think this about men.
Sure,
you know,
sure, sure.
It's like men think this way. That's what you learn. And the goal is to unpack that and understand that everyone's an individual and has their own perspective. But whether I'm labeled as like this lefty, liberal lefty, whether I'm labeled as a race traitor, whether I'm labeled as whatever, the idea that if you do not simply go along with whatever all these other people have already written, white people have already said and written about race and white identity development, if you have a different opinion than that, you're disloyal, or you're undereducated, or you're missing. You're a problem. And I think that believing, like having no room for dissension or differing opinions, we do to ourselves what we claim the other side does. Which is that none of us are, we don't know why an individual went into that voting booth and voted the way they voted. Right. Unless you ask them specifically, why did you vote this way? You don't know why people feel the way they feel about things unless you ask them, but to ascribe it to some identity and say, well, all men think this way, or all women think this way, or all white people, or all black people, or whatever. I felt like there wasn't a lot of room at this conference for, and what was notably absent. And I think that I know a lot about this just, you know, because I'm working on my dissertation and I've tried to read things from so many different authors and so many different thought leaders in the space. But the folks from the Othering and Belonging Institute out of Berkeley were notably absent at this conference. So there were no workshops put on by those folks. And I don't know the politics in this ecosphere. Like, I don't know if there's like fiefdoms, right? Like, this is our space and our conference, or this is our space and our conference. But there were so many people from the White Privilege Conference that I heard when I went that were not part of this. Okay, I don't know why. It's just interesting. Like, why, if Robin DiAngelo is such a big deal in this space, then why was Robin DiAngelo, who's written all these books for white, like Debbie Irving, Peggy McIntosh, these are some white women who were at this White Privilege Conference who were nowhere to be seen in this space. Mm. People from the Othering and Belonging Institute weren't there. Now, one of their pamphlets was in the tote bag, but again, so there wasn't a lot of conversation about what we gain or lose by othering.
Right.
But othering as a concept was pretty prevalent at this conference.
Very prevalent.
And so I just found it interesting, and I understand it's also a coping mechanism. Sure. It is useful to villainize the other side. I like what you said about a traumatic relationship, and I don't want to make this analogy lightly, but there is a bit of a domestic abuse overlay
to
white versus black, right?
Yeah. So
usually in those relationships, you have a man abusing a woman, whether emotionally, financially, physically, all or in combination. And it's a reflection of the power hierarchy in society, brought down to the interpersonal level, right?
Yeah.
And so if you're a good therapist and you are trying to engage with a couple, so in many ways, the way we respond to domestic violence is sort of similar to the way we respond to white supremacy. So the perpetrator is a problem. We make them wrong. We deal with, we met out punishment. And we infantilize the victim. And very rarely does it feel okay to say to the victim, So what is it about you that drew you into this relationship or kept you in it?
Mm-hmm.
And I realize that now saying that out loud, people are also going to write in about how structurally there are plenty of reasons how this happens, right? There's growing up in a patriarchal society has you deferential to male power, you know, your own trauma, but also structural things like being paid less than men for the same amount of work, or being saddled with childcare that takes you out of the workforce and then makes it less likely that you're able to support yourself. Like, oh, I realize there's all the structural things and there's the interpersonal things, and you got to work on both. But we have to come up with better ways of unpacking all of this together. And these are some of the same people who like really push for restorative justice, right? As a
Yeah, yeah.
And yet, you know, we're still, and I'm not trying to other the people I'm talking about that are othering, right? Like,
are we othering the other?
This is tough stuff. And there are ways of coping, and fighting is a coping strategy. Like, when I listened in some of these workshops too, I was thinking about the five responses, right, to trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Fight, fawn, flop, or what, and I can't remember what the fifth one is. But like, a lot of our responses to all of this work is to just pick a path like that and be like, and the path of this conference,
yeah,
is don't you flee, don't you fawn, don't you run away, you fight. We are here to fight. And I think that if you're going to fight, you need someone to fight against. And I think that only is the cycle that keeps us in this.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Yeah. And the other to fight against, you know, there has to be disdain. There has to be disrespect. There has to be all these elements that I heard cropping up in how we were describing the people on the other side of that equation, you know, and not pausing long enough to either examine, you know, who's actually on that other side of the equation, because some of us on that other side of the equation looks just like me, right? Just voted differently, and actually recognizing that. And again, you said it earlier, you know, we're dealing in a world of nuance, and to pretend that we can fix everything with the same hammer, I think is one of the failures in this work. You know, sometimes we need that precision screwdriver or a wrench to apply to the issue that is in front of us. And yeah, if we hit it hard enough with a hammer, maybe it, you know, it looks like it works or it disappears for a moment, but it's not fixed. And if we get into this idea and concept of really making change, that means finding ways outside of what traditionally has been our approach, and realizing that we have to have a more subtle and nuanced approach to things sometimes. And look, I said it when we were at the conference, and this is let's walk our othering back a little bit. The voices that were raised and the way they were raised, they have a place that is important in how we propel this work forward. All the voices do. So that woman who said, no, I don't want to sit with you and do the work, that's an important voice, because that person is expressing her agency. She's drawing a line and setting a limit. And that's critical to how we function and how we heal. However, we have to say yes and, you know, who in the room is willing to sit with this woman as she does the work? Yeah. Oh, I can. Well, there's a person of color over there who can sit with her. And so I think that when we begin to look at that more nuanced approach, we can really start expecting and looking for the kind of changes that we're really trying to create.
And as a callback to an earlier episode,
call it back.
I think it's fascinating. I just was listening to you thinking your emotional maturity is often, I think, what is labeled as you're not Black enough. Because if you were Black enough, you'd be mad.
Come on now, sister. I have my fist raised with my Black glove on, and I'd be like, right on. Yeah. And I felt that way a lot of times at the conference. I just wasn't Black enough. No one said it, but it was it was definitely the environment, the feeling in the room, you know, the temperature. It's like, hey, but wait, and I know we don't have a lot of time, but I just want to say this, and we can take it up in another episode, but what role do we as Black men have? Because nobody spoke of it. Black men were not addressed. It wasn't like, Black men, here's what you can do to help further this cause, right? A lot of talk about Black women, rightfully so. Also, where was the engagement for white men? There were white men there. I made a connection with a guy that I'm hoping we can start having a relationship. But where was, I've heard nothing directly toward him saying, hey, white man, here is your work. Here is your task. Here's what you're facing, what you're challenged with, and an assignment made to him. What is that? Talk to me about how you see that dynamic.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. So I do think that there are some spaces. I mean, there are some groups I know of that are trying to organize white men. But you are right. There's a lot of women in this space, both white and Black and other ethnicities and races. A lot of women. I would say, I wish we knew the demographics of the conference.
Yeah, that would be good. I wonder if they published them.
But it was a lot of women. I think this is part of this sort of like othering, right? Like just the shut up and sit down. White guys, you've ruined so much of the world. Just shut up and sit down.
Yeah.
Shut up and sit down. And I realize that for folks who like, okay, like if you don't get it and if you don't understand, if you haven't done the work and you don't think you have any privilege or whatever, if you're dealing with your own stuff, yeah, go sit in the chair over there until and either never participate or someone should come and sit with you and help you learn the stuff and all that. But the shut up and sit down, I think, is part of this. And I think it's an outgrowth of the feminist movement for sure, right? But I can't speak to the Black man. You unpacking the gender dynamics in your race is its own podcast series, right?
Oh, without a doubt.
So I can't really, it's a good thing to know. I do want to say in the few minutes we have left, the one last thing I wanted to kind of bring up to pivot just a little was around the conversation. A lot of the conversation was around the legality of DEIA. I went to a lot of those workshops that talked about how to continue to do DEIA work in your organization. Some of them that I went to were sponsored by this government, GAR, which I've already now forgotten what it is called, Governing for Racial Justice. And they talked a lot about not kind of preemptively complying with something that you don't know whether or not it's a law that's going to be coming down. And that if you have a lawyer in your organization who's telling you to stop calling something DEIA or stop having, I'm part of this volunteer club and we've just spent a month arguing about whether or not we could offer as a club a discount, a BIPOC discount,
right,
to provide more accessibility to the club because it's got a lot of white people in it.
Yeah.
And some Black folks who are part of the club were like, yeah, you should have a discount that will increase accessibility. And other Black people were like, that's such a performative piece of shit thing to do. And you're assuming all Black people are poor.
Yeah.
And it's like, both are people of color with this particular perspective. Yes, the discount, no, the discount. Sure. And part of the conversation was, well, we talked to our lawyers and our lawyer said that if we offer a BIPOC discount, we're going to get sued.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the Supreme Court decision on higher ed admission.
And
a lot of the conference was talking about don't apply a law that doesn't have anything to do with what you're doing to what you're doing in anticipation that you're going to get sued. But one of the more, I don't know, I guess the thing that I felt the most optimistic about hearing was, listen, we have to change. Don't get so attached to the name of something that you have to change its name in order to keep moving forward. Number one. Yeah. Number two, instead of being pissed off at the pushback to feeling excluded by white people in a let's do something special for Black people. So see, someone like me who grew up with money, I have no issue with trying to do things that increase accessibility because finances are a barrier, sure. Right? Because I grew up with money. I've never had the feeling of like, well, I can't do that because I don't have the money.
Right, right.
But when I watched white people say, why should they get a discount when I don't get a discount? And we just say, oh, you're being racist. I think we miss the opportunity to say, well, why isn't the economy working for you?
Right.
You're white. We thought all white people had money.
Right, exactly. Right?
So I think we're missing something when white people push back against something that seems to specifically benefit a color or gender or orientation that we don't have. To me, that's like somebody saying, I feel excluded. Oh, well, why do you feel excluded? Let's look into that. Why are you feeling excluded? And if it's, you're just a dick because you're privileged and you didn't
right.
That's totally different. But I think that 75 million people who voted for Trump,
sure,
65, whatever the millions are, and then all the people who didn't vote.
Right.
To write that off or within government or within these initiatives, DEIA initiatives, to say, well, we can't do this work anymore because people are pushing back. We'll find out why they're pushing back.
Mm-hmm.
And what am I trying to say?
I don't know. What are you trying to say?
I know. I think the policies that I notice that people push back on, the people who push back on them, are not from a privileged class.
Right.
They may have one privileged identity, but they don't have a whole suite of privileged identities.
Right.
I think
we
lose something in those conversations when we don't explore that other stuff. And I think the thing I felt hopeful from, the one thing I did feel hopeful from the conference, was there's more than one way to get this work accomplished. Don't get attached to what you call it, that you're unwilling to change the name of it just to simply be okay. But also, don't die on a hill of something that actually isn't effective, but is symbolic. So I don't know if Walmart's DEIA stuff was effective by whatever measures folks of color at Walmart would have thought was effective. But make sure that what you're doing actually is effective for the people that it was designed to be effective for.
Sure.
Before you worry about, well, they're going to kill our program. Well, is your program a good program? Is it working to accomplish the things? And there's more than one way to get this work done. And somebody, we talked about, God, should we have named this organization something else? Because now it's got some scarlet letters in it.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Yeah. But I do feel like it's how we define DEIA. It's what is our goal in the work? And if you define it for people and they're still opposed to it, great. But if you define it for people, they're like, oh, I didn't know that's what you meant. Like inclusion for everyone. diversity and accessibility and equity for all, we are lumping so many things under one category when there's so much nuance, as you say, kind of under the surface. Sorry, that was like a long monologue. I don't even, maybe I'll even cut it out.
It was a bit of a soliloquy, but you know, you and Shakespeare
lost.
Have so much in common. It's okay. No, I mean, it was a good train of thought, and I think it was important, an important distinction, and a way, I think, to really kind of at least close this episode of our discussion about the Facing Race conference, in acknowledging that there were really some powerful, moving, and important things that came out of it.
For sure.
Regardless of what criticism we may have of it, the sheer power of it was in itself an achievement and worthwhile. And I grew so much by being there and learned so much from so many. So
and
it was
anyone who puts on a conference anywhere in any city should take a look at what Race Forward did to partner with the local community.
Oh, that was outstanding.
To donate money. I mean, they made money on this conference. 4,000 people came, but they made grants and donations to community-based organizations. They highlighted local artists.
Well, that was one of the best things that I enjoyed. The highlighting of local artists and talent was and giving them that stage that I'm sure some of them would have never had a stage of 4,000, right? Yeah, and it was awesome
and
to
maybe
watch
that. Maybe that that comedian shouldn't have had a stage.
Okay.
4,000.
Yeah,
we're not going to talk about that.
I'm not even going to get into that. But yeah, he probably should have had a stage of about 15. But I'm just saying.
You listen, dude. You don't make fun of your grandma.
No.
Don't make fun of your grandma.
You can make fun of yourself about your grandma, but you don't throw your grandmother under the bus to the level he did. And anyone who was at the conference that has to be listening to this, you know what we're saying.
If you know, you know. Hey, I'm really grateful that I got to experience that conference with you because we have talked about a lot of this stuff for a long time. And this was our first time going to like some major big gathering of people in this space. And just to be able to talk to you in between sessions and at dinner and stuff, I really appreciated. I appreciate your perspective. And it's not just because I agree with it, although that helps. but you know, I do. So thank you for going with me.
Yeah. Well, I think the same, I have to say the same to you. It was great to experience, that space. This is a space you've talked about quite often. You've gone to other workshops before the, inception of this organization, but you've talked about them, and to actually have the experience to be there and to see it for myself on this scale was powerful. And our conversations afterwards in more private spaces was really powerful too. You know, we're winding down the year, you know, we probably won't pick up until January, and we just got through Thanksgiving going into Christmas. I just want to say how much I appreciate you, the work you do, your attitude, your energy, and what you bring. And, you know, we may not change the entire world, but I think we can make a little bit of a difference in a corner. So let's do it. Let's keep it up.
Okay, you got it. Happy holidays to everyone. As he said, we're probably not going to do another episode until February. We're going to concentrate in January on putting on our very first training. So we're excited about that. So when we come back
Woo-hoo!
In February.
Is that right? Woo-hoo!
No, that's not how it goes.
I always tell Jerise, as Black folk, we don't really woo-woo. So I've
Woo-hoo!
Been working on my woo-woo. I've been working on my woo-woo.
No good.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and have a good holiday.